Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
"30 Issues in 30 Days," our 2010 election series, issue 5. Did Andrew Cuomo help cause the housing bubble? The Democratic nominee for governor of New York was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under President Clinton from 1997 through the end of Clinton's term at the beginning of 2001, at a time when the government was expanding its home mortgage guarantees to expand home ownership. The Bush administration, we should say right up front, kept and added to these changes. But did they turn out to be good policy or a tragic overreach? Here is the same short clip of Andrew Cuomo that we played before the news as HUD secretary in 1998.
Aggressively to take a greater risk on these mortgages, yes. To give families mortgages who they would not have given otherwise, yes.
Yes. And in a few minutes, we'll debate the question, what should happen now? Should the government get out of the business of guaranteeing home mortgage loans? But first, let's look more deeply at the history of HUD at the time Andrew Cuomo was in charge. Here is about another minute of then HUD Secretary Cuomo from that same appearance on C-SPAN in 1998.
Last year, the Federal Reserve Board found African Americans are denied credit for homes at twice the rate white Americans are. And it is pervasive. It's what we found in the banking case in Texas, AccuBank in Texas. Discrimination in lending, discrimination in rendering mortgages. The bank has agreed to change its practices, as you heard from the assistant secretary. The bank has also agreed to a $2.1 billion agreement where they'll make $2.1 billion available to families who are low and moderate income across the country for mortgages. About 15,000 low and moderate income people will now be able to buy their own home because of the settlement we announced today.
Andrew Cuomo as HUD Secretary in 1998. Joining me now are Village Voice political columnist Wayne Barrett, who has written on this topic, and Dean Baker, co-director of the liberal-leaning think tank, the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean and Wayne, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Hey, thanks for being
in. Wayne, you wrote an article in The Voice in, was it August of 2008?
Yes.
So that was a month before the collapse of Lehman started the full-blown financial sector meltdown, but when foreclosures were already mushrooming.
Yeah.
The article was called Andrew Cuomo and Fannie and Freddie, How the Youngest HUD Secretary in History Gave Birth to the Mortgage Crisis. You write that in 2000, Cuomo required a quantum leap in the number of affordable, low to moderate income loans that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would have to buy. And we just heard that clip from 98 where he says something that almost sounds, you know, unbelievable from today's vantage point with all this hindsight. Aggressively to take a greater risk on these mortgages? Yes. To give families mortgages who they would not have given otherwise? Yes. So what exactly was he up to in the late 90s?
Well, I think you set it up correctly. Both the Bush and the Clinton administrations, if they agreed on one economic policy, it was to promote home ownership, particularly among minorities, but among those who previously had been locked out of the home ownership market. Now, you could say that was well motivated. You could say that was good policy at its time. But in my story, for example, I quoted from Franklin Raines, who was the head of Fannie Mae at the time and the first black to be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. When Cuomo issued the rules that forced him into the subprime market, he said, "We have not been a major presence in the subprime market, but you can bet under these goals we will be." So it's not all hindsight. In fact, Stephen Holmes, a Times reporter, New York Times reporter, wrote at the time, in moving even tentatively into this new area of lending, Fannie Mae is taking on significantly more risk, which may not pose any difficulties during flush economic times, but the government-subsidized corporation may run into trouble in an economic downturn, prompting a government rescue similar to that of the savings and loan industry in the 1980s. Mm. So it's not all hindsight. The warnings were out there when Andrew did it. The warnings were even coming from Fannie when Andrew did it. And, of course, the first black president of a major company being forced by Andrew, in fact, being said, "You're locking blacks out of the market," was precisely the kind of incentive that Raines needed to get deeply into the market.
And before we get to Dean's take on this, just a little further background from your article, which says in 1995, the previous Clinton HUD secretary, Henry Cisneros, required that 42% of all Fannie and Freddie mortgages serve low to moderate income borrowers. Cuomo expanded that to 50% required to serve low and moderate income borrowers, and radically hiked the requirement for Fannie and Freddie to buy mortgages specifically in underserved neighborhoods and among the very low income, as it was put. Now, again,
Brian, could I just add one thing? In this rulemaking that he issued at that time, I think the critical decision, which the Times recently wrote about in an A1 story, was you could say the goals were well-motivated, but he didn't require Fannie and Freddie to disclose the terms of any of these riskier mortgages that they were taking on.
To whom?
So, to disclose publicly the terms, to disclose it to HUD, to disclose it to anybody, which there was a big fight over at the time as to whether or not a lot of the housing advocates who wanted to see these new housing goals imposed, they also wanted the terms of them to be disclosed. And he really went into the tank with the industry in making sure that it did not have to disclose. And I think the Times, you know, in their recent story, they kind of vetted my work of 2008. They had some disagreements with me, but this is one on which they totally agree that the great failing of Cuomo's rulemaking was that there were no disclosure requirements whatsoever that Fannie and Freddie had to live up to. So it became a great secret as to what kind of loans they were guaranteeing.
And again, to keep this in the context of the bipartisan policy that this really was, if HUD under Cuomo and Clinton hiked the requirement to 50% of Freddie and Fannie mortgages going to low to moderate income borrowers, by 2007 in the Bush administration, it was up to 56%. So Dean Baker, bad idea looking back on it through the lens of today, and how should anybody judge Andrew Cuomo's fitness to be governor in this context?
This is really, I think, totally skewed. I mean, I was actually trashing Fannie and Freddie back in 02, 03, 04, 05, but to blame them for, you know, the worst abuses in the housing market just ignores what went on there. There was a history of discrimination against blacks and Latinos that's been well documented by any number of very well-respected economists. And in that context, to say that Fannie and Freddie should do something about that, I think, is hardly something to complain about. Now, did they make a lot of irresponsible loans? Absolutely. But the most irresponsible loans were being made by private issuers, or I should say securitized by the private issuers, and that's easily shown. If you look at what was going on, 03, 04, 05, 06, Fannie and Freddie's market share was going through the floor. It was Goldman, it was Merrill Lynch, it was Citigroup. They were securitizing the worst garbage that was coming out of Century, Countrywide, you know, the worst of these subprime and Alt-A mortgages. So believe me, Fannie and Freddie did not act well, and they deserved their share of the criticism, and I was giving it to them back in 02 and 03. But to somehow blame them or their desire to serve the minority community as what caused this bubble, that's crazy.
Well, contributed to the bubble, and, you know, even the framing of the question is, did Cuomo help to cause? But
could I just ask Dean whether or not, I mean, I just said that the Times and I agreed on at least one part of this, which is that the terms of the loans should have been disclosed and were never disclosed, and Andrew made that ruling. What's your take on that, Dean?
Yeah, no, look, I have plenty of criticism of Fannie and Freddie, that being one of them.
This is a criticism of Andrew's rulemaking. Do you agree with that?
That's right. I don't work for him or his opponent. Yeah, no, that's right. I believe in disclosure. These are public, well, they're completely public companies now, but I mean, even, you know, even back before the takeover, before they went bankrupt, they were public-private companies, and I think you should have disclosure. I mean, the whole point is, you know, at least their goal of securing increasing home ownership is we want to know that people not just are buying homes, but they're going to be able to hold them.
And Dean, what about the aggressiveness of the risk-taking? Again, that clip of Cuomo on C-SPAN in 98 saying aggressively to take a greater risk on these mortgages. Yes, to give families mortgages who they would not have given otherwise. Yes, so there was some calculation that more risk was acceptable and, in fact, desirable as public policy. And you heard Wayne describe some of the, you know, the cautionary warnings that were coming even at the time.
Yeah, well, there are a couple different issues here. One is, look, banks weren't making loans to African Americans, Hispanics, who otherwise outwardly had the same characteristics, you know, income, wealth, other characteristics as the white people coming through their door. Now, their answer was they perceived greater risk. So in that context, I could perfectly well understand Cuomo or anyone else telling them, well, you're going to have to take greater risk then. Now, the point back in 98, we didn't have a housing bubble. We just had the very beginnings of a housing bubble. So taking greater risk in a context where house prices are more or less holding their own is not all that risky. It becomes very risky in a context we were in 04, 05, 06, where house prices were overvalued by 60, 70% in some areas, you know, more than that. Then it's very, very risky. If you have someone who can't meet a mortgage and the house is only worth half the value of the mortgage, then you're going to take a really big hit. So in 98, there was not as much at risk in making a bad mortgage as there was 5 or 6 or 7 years later.
I want to update the Cuomo record and go beyond his Clinton years, because, Wayne, you wrote
all
in
right,
that...
Let me just say something about, you know, I'm obviously not opposed to policies that are intending to enlarge mortgage opportunities for minorities. I don't think that's the issue here. I think the issue is that what was Andrew's motive? It's very, very difficult to figure out motive in public policy. And, it, you know, this obviously had tremendous benefits for the Mortgage Bankers Association that tremendously championed this. It had tremendous advantages for many interest groups, including Fannie and Freddie, who had 88 lobbyists at the time, some of whom were very close to Andrew that I laid out in this. So whether Andrew's motive was solely to enlarge the opportunities for minorities, it seems to me to be very questionable, especially when he accompanied it with a decision that said, we're going to bow to the demands of the industry and not require any disclosure. And then secondly, in that story that I wrote in 2008, I discussed yield spread premiums. Now, yield spread premiums are this absolutely odious policy that Andrew legalized by an official rulemaking in 1999. 9 out of 10 subprime mortgages carry yield spread premiums, which are these payments essentially where the borrower thinks the broker is representing him, but actually the broker is representing the lender, and the lender is going to pay the broker, the mortgage broker, an additional sum if he can get a borrower to take a mortgage at an interest rate far above par or normal. And Andrew's the one who legalized them, and 9 out of 10 subprime mortgages carried it. I think that says something about what was motivating Andrew at the time when he was making these decisions, because while there is some justification for the public policy on Fannie and Freddie, there's no justification for the policy on the yield spread premiums other than a cave into the special interest groups.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this is a pernicious practice, and it's being somewhat cleaned up just now, but you're absolutely right. There's no justification for that. And I won't speak for his motives. I don't know, but, you know, I think one could be reasonably well suspicious there what they were.
Wayne, in that 2008 article, you wrote that the history is important. And again, this was before the financial collapse, but there were a lot of foreclosures and declining home prices already. That the history is important not just to understand the subprime crisis, but also because Cuomo, as New York State Attorney General, in 08 was trying to don a white hat, as you put it, in dealing with foreclosures. So what has his record as Attorney General been on this issue?
Well, you know, the Federal Reserve recently issued an opinion, finally, saying that yield spread premiums were inappropriate or improper. And I called down to the Federal Reserve to find out, because they cite a group of attorney generals who petitioned them to make this ruling, and Andrew was not among them. I think there were 13 New York State Attorney Generals around the country that petitioned for this change, and Andrew was not among them. I don't know if he has seen the error of his ways on some of these points, but I think he's had a remarkably good record as an Attorney General on many other issues. I haven't seen anything that directly counters some of the positions that he took here that troubled me when I wrote about them in 2008. But I think his dealing with the credit rating agencies and many other factors that contributed to the meltdown has been remarkably strong. I mean, he's the guy who's given us all the bonus babies. He's done so much in that office, I think, to try to attack some of the causes, the Bank of America case, many other cases that he's been involved with to try to attack some of the causes of the meltdown.
So help contribute to and help address the problems that were created by the housing bubble would be the record, according to Wayne Barrett. By the way, Wayne, before you go, and Dean is going to stay for part two of this, where was Carl Palladino in 1998 as a real estate developer when Washington was expanding mortgage guarantees? Was he protesting them or taking advantage of them, or do either of you know?
Well, you did get to my current focus of study, but I'm in the reporting phase, Brian. I will tell you, it was somewhat disconcerting to me. I don't know if you saw it, but Carl Palladino came up with an advertisement today, taken entirely from another story I wrote about Andrew in 2006.
I didn't see that yet.
Sometimes our words come back to haunt us.
Do you want to? I haven't seen that ad. Do you want to talk back to the new Palladino ad in any way?
Well, no. I mean, he accurately represents what I wrote. He's just talking into the camera. It's a story I did on Andrew Farkas and the $2 million man. I remember you and I discussed it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrew's—he's the finance chair of Andrew's current campaign, and he has contributed an enormous amount to Andrew, and Andrew did some things at HUD that were very favorable to Andrew Farkas, a very questionable guy.
And Dean, do you have anything on Palladino in the whole mortgage bubble era?
Yeah, I can't say I really know anything about his past there, so I really can't speak to it.
Okay, so I'll have to address that in another segment. Wayne Barrett, thank you very much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Now, Dean Baker is going to stay as we go to part two of this conversation, which will be a current policy debate on whether the government should stay in the business of guaranteeing mortgages. Truth is, they're actually more in it today than they were even before the meltdown. And we will add another guest and talk about what the government should do next. Some people say, hey, the whole institution of the 30-year mortgage would disintegrate in America without these government guarantees. Some people say just the opposite, so we'll continue in a minute. And listeners, you can comment on this topic now at our political website. It's freecountry.org. And while you're there, we want your thoughts on another breaking story today. Rick Lazio, who lost the Republican gubernatorial nomination to Carl Palladino, is officially announcing at noon whether he plans to continue running for governor on the conservative party line, which he has available to him. Again, that announcement by Lazio is expected at noon, and it's freecountry.org. We'll bring you the latest updates. You can comment now on the possible Lazio re-entry. Do you think he should throw his hat back into the ring on the conservative party line? Would this change your vote? The comments thread is open. Find it at itsafreecountry.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's 30 Issues in 30 Days, our election series. We've been talking about Andrew Cuomo's role as HUD secretary in the 90s in expanding subprime loans. Now let's look at the underlying policy question going forward. Should the government stay in the business of guaranteeing home loans anymore, or let the market take care of that? Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research is still with us, and we are also joined by Peter Wallison from the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, who served as a Treasury Department official in the Reagan administration. He's also the author of books including Nationalizing Mortgage Risk, The Growth of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which was published in 2000. So, Peter Wallison, welcome to WNYC. Thank you very much for joining this conversation.
Pleasure to be here.
And in a recent article that you wrote for Bloomberg News, you challenged the idea that the market in the U.S. cannot support the conventional 30-year mortgage for most families without government guarantees. Explain the argument for that conventional wisdom as you see it and why you don't agree.
Well, I think this is one of the arguments in favor of the government continuing to be involved in the mortgage system, and that is that we need the government in order to have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. But if you go on the internet, go on Google and type in 30-year fixed rate jumbo mortgage, and I specify jumbo because that's a mortgage that is not worked on or bought by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, now you'll find that many 30-year fixed rate jumbo mortgages are being offered. In other words, they're being offered in the private sector, and it's obvious.
What's the cutoff for a jumbo mortgage? How big a mortgage?
Well, it's about $450,000 in general, but in expensive areas, that is, everything under $450,000 can be bought and is bought by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. In expensive areas, it can go up to as high as about $729,000.
So doesn't that mean that the rich are still rich if the jumbo mortgages are still being offered? Does that say anything about the rest of us?
There are always mortgages being offered by banks over the amount that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac can purchase. It doesn't say anything about rich or poor. And the point is that these mortgages are always available, and 30-year fixed-rate mortgages are also available in that market. So it is a canard that the government has to be involved in order for there to be 30-year fixed-rate mortgages.
Do you advocate...
For people who are taking mortgages less than $450,000, which are now handled by Fannie and Freddie.
What do you think would happen if Fannie and Freddie just ceased to be, at least in terms of the government guarantees that they carry?
Today, it would be a catastrophe. Fannie and Freddie are the only organizations that are buying middle-class mortgages from banks and from other originators. So in order to keep our financial system, or at least our housing financial system, operating, we do need Fannie and Freddie today. But the point is, when we are at a time that we're no longer in this crisis, we are not coming out of the results of what I think were Fannie and Freddie's previous work, then we can have a system that does not rely on the government. And our reliance in the past has only caused huge costs to the taxpayers. In the case of Fannie and Freddie today, it will probably be cost to the taxpayers of more than $400 billion for the losses that they have already baked in the cake in the work they did up to the time they were taken over by the government. And if we look back in history, the S&L industry also collapsed after the taxpayers, after the support they had gotten from the government. Taxpayers had to pick up the losses there, which were about $150 billion. So we ought to be looking at a system that does not require the government's involvement.
Dean Baker, I presume you disagree. Why should the government guarantee loans? Why should not the loans be between the lender and the borrower? And if you can afford the kind of mortgage that would allow you to buy a house, great. If you can't, then you continue to be a renter.
Well, I actually don't completely disagree. I think Peter made some very good points, and I've been making the exact same point about the jumbo mortgage market. So, you know, we can, the argument that if you didn't have Fannie and Freddie, you would not have a 30-year mortgage, it's easily refuted. There's a jumbo market that's not supported by Fannie and Freddie, and I haven't looked lately. The last time I looked, the gap between the mortgage rates were around 8 or 9 tenths of a percentage point. I do think Fannie and Freddie have played a useful role. I would take issue with what Peter was saying about them being the primary culprits. I mean, I have plenty of things to criticize about them. I just did, you know, a moment ago on your show. They did support the bubble, but the worst actors there were the private issuers, Citigroup and Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch and the rest. They were the ones that were buying up and selling the worst, the subprime and the Alt-A mortgages. Fannie and Freddie got into that late in the game. And again, I don't defend them. It's just that they were, it's simply not accurate to say that they were the big actors there. They came to it late and did it to preserve market share, not out of an interest in fostering home ownership. But if we're to keep them, I would say go back to the old Fannie model, what you had prior to 68, 69, when they originally went from being a fully government company to a mixed public-private company, and have them just buy and hold mortgages. That would, you know, the idea being that it's simple and cheap. And that could save money. I mean, to my mind, that's a useful public purpose. But unfortunately, or at least in my view, unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be on anyone's agenda here in Washington. So if the choice is between some sort of mixed public-private or some sort of, to my mind, probably somewhat convoluted system of having a public guarantee issued by a private corporation, I would just as soon say, no, just go back to the private sector. If we want to subsidize home ownership, we already do that. If we want to do it more, we could do that through the tax system. It's probably an easier and simpler way, and it does involve less risk. I mean, Peter's right on that.
Well, the two of you agree more than I might have guessed before you both came on. But, Peter, is there a public policy good to making it easier for more people to afford home mortgages you know, we discussed in the previous segment how this has been a unified policy of the Clinton administration and the Bush administration over a 16-year period of increasing the percentage of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loans that were going to low and moderate income families and in underserved neighborhoods. And I guess, you know, maybe there were other reasons in there, too, like who was lobbying for what from the banking industry. But there did seem also to be a perception of the American dream, expanding the American dream, so more people could own homes, backing up these mortgages. Is that not a proper goal of public policy, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think there is a value in the government helping people to get homes, but on a limited basis. The trouble with using Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is that it was completely out of control. And actually, I do disagree with Dean on his numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now hold, or at least held in 2008, when they were finally taken over, 12 million subprime and Alt-A loans, which they had been required to buy because of government policy. You add to that FHA, which is, in fact, the legitimate on-budget government organization that is supposed to be helping people who cannot afford a prime mortgage. You add FHA, you add the other buyers that either did it because they are government agencies or were required to do so by government, and you have 19 million subprime and Alt-A loans on the balance sheet of the government today, with a total of 27 million bad loans in the financial system as a whole. So if you look at who was really responsible for the collapse of the mortgage system, it was the government that either bought these loans itself through FHA or required Fannie and Freddie to do it, starting in 1992 and coming right up through the Clinton administration and into the Bush administration, as you're suggesting. But there is a good reason for government to assist some people, but it has to be to a limited extent, and there was no limitation placed on what Fannie and Freddie could do. In fact, Fannie and Freddie were pushed to do more and more by HUD and by Congress up until 2008 when they were finally taken over.
If you look at the sequence, you see that Fannie and Freddie had held 70-80% of the mortgage market through the 90s into the beginning of the last decade, and then it plummeted as you had this explosion of subprime mortgages, subprime and Alt-A, and then you had them being securitized through private issuers. And then Fannie and Freddie, and you could find this in their documents, they were losing market share. These are businesses, and they were losing market share like crazy. They were under 50%, and they jumped into it. They said quite explicitly, we're concerned about market share. That wasn't the Bush administration and Congress telling them to do it. That was their businesses losing market share. So, I mean, you could blame them.
Afraid,
I mean, they shouldn't have done
but that was
the motivation.
I have to really disagree with those facts. That is not what happened. Fannie and Freddie gradually increased their purchases of subprime and Alt-A loans all the way through this period of 2001 through 2008 because of government requirements.
Did they lose market share?
They were the principal buyers of the private mortgage packages that were being created by Wall Street. They bought most of those mortgages from Wall Street.
Peter,
so they were not competing with Wall Street for market share. They were trying to buy those mortgages because they needed them to meet their affordable housing requirements. It is a myth that they were competing with Wall Street. They were, in fact, the biggest buyers from Wall Street. So these are facts that will have to come out over time when people get a better opportunity to look at some of the data. But when you understand where the bad mortgages are actually held today, and they are held on the balance sheets of various government agencies, including Fannie and Freddie, you understand why we had so many mortgages created, and it wasn't by Wall Street.
Dean, you can have one more comeback on this.
Yeah, I mean, the data is pretty clear. The private issuers' market share soared 2003-04, and I have documents from, well, actually, I had the best one I could identify was from Moody's, where they were discussing how they would be considering a downgrade. I think it was a Freddie, except that Freddie intends to get more aggressively involved in the Alt-A and subprime market. And they weren't talking about their commitment to home ownership. They were talking about market share and profits of a private business.
What to each of you is at stake in this conversation? It's fascinating, for me at least, to listen to, and it echoes the debate in the political sector where Republicans in general say government policy with respect to expanding Fannie and Freddie and loan guarantees into more and more lower-income Americans mostly caused the bubble and the crisis. Democrats more saying, no, it was the greed of Wall Street and securitizing all these mortgages in the private sector that more caused it. What's at stake in deciding that it was one thing or the other? Dean, is something at stake?
Well, I think there is something at stake, is whether we think the private sector left to itself can be counted on to be responsible and not to have sort of inflating bubbles like this. And, you know, my view is, no, they were part of the story. And again, I've never been one to apologize for Fannie and Freddie. They were horrible, and they could have been great. They could have been great break on the process if they had required that there be appraisals of rent and they issue mortgages based on price to rent ratios. That probably would have stopped the bubble in its tracks, but I can't blame them for most of the story here.
Peter, same question. What's at stake in deciding that you're right or that Dean is right?
A policy in the future is at stake, and if we decide that the government should remain in housing finance, we are going to run into exactly the same problem, some crisis in the future, because government's involvement creates moral hazard, or it creates efforts on the part of Congress to assist constituencies of various kinds in using the government's credit in some way. And in the end, we end up with the government, as occurred with the SNLs and as occurred with Fannie and Freddie, having to take huge losses which go to the taxpayers. So the real thing at stake here is the question of whether we get the government involved or we don't. And my view is the best policy for the taxpayers in the future is to keep the government out.
And Dean, a last word, and we're out of time.
Yeah, well, just to be clear, I mean, the involvement with the SNLs was basically like FDIC insurance at banks. And maybe Peter wants to get rid of that, but I think that's been very helpful in stabilizing the banking system. I don't think there is a way to get the government out. We need the right role, and obviously we didn't have that in the last decade. But that the government was out in the 20s. That gave us the Great Depression. I don't think we want to go back there.
Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Peter Wallison, the Arthur Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He was also a counsel to the Treasury Department in the Reagan administration and author of books including Nationalizing Mortgage Risk, The Growth of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, published in 2000. Thank you both very much for coming on and having this crucial conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That's our 30 Issues in 30 Days segment for today. Tomorrow, we turn from what Andrew Cuomo was responsible for to what Carl Paladino is responsible for when we ask if Carl Paladino has the character to be governor. And listeners, you can comment on the topic we just had now at itsafreecountry.org, our politics website. While you're there, we want your thoughts on another breaking story. Rick Lazio, who lost the Republican gubernatorial nomination to Paladino, is officially announcing at noon whether he plans to continue running for governor on the conservative party line. Should Rick Lazio stay in the race? Post your thoughts to itsafreecountry.org. And coming up in just a minute, a contest for emerging artists in New York City.